This meeting of the Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order. We have three bills on the agenda, and I think the first one is a fairly quick one, but Senator Carlson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and committees, my bill is Senate File 302, which is a multiple sclerosis drug copayment limitation. And for the purposes of the committee, this is an initiative to lower the copayment for persons who have or under treatment for multiple sclerosis, and it's a pharmaceutical that has gone from a copay of approximately $50 to over $200 because it has changed its tier, the treatment of that particular pharmaceutical. It's actually no more complicated than that, is to try to limit the copay for persons that are covered with private insurance in Minnesota. And from what I understand, you have Senator Coring, who would like to say something before he leaves this chamber here, and then we'll go on with our testimony after that.
Well, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Carlson, I want to, before I have to leave, I'm actually going to be leaving to go back to my district. The superintendent of schools in Royalton was killed in a car accident in the memorial services today, and I will be attending that. And so, but I did want to speak on your bill, and I want to sincerely thank you, Senator Carlson, for bringing this forward. I have some very personal stories about this, but I'm not going to go into it. But I just want to say that I know I do see some people that are on the list that are opposed to it, and I'm sorry to see that, but I guess that happens. But I think it's just plain common sense. The increases, now tell me if I'm right, Senator Carlson, the proposal that you're putting forward would be, right now I think it's $25 for 3 months. Your proposal is $50 per month, which is actually a 300% increase, and the current numbers are $25 for 3 months, $200 per month, a $1,200 increase, and so you're proposing the $300 increase, is that correct?
Senator Coring, Mr. Chair and Senator Coring, that is a 1,200% increase.
Yes, but the bill that you're proposing is a 300% increase, correct?
That's correct,
yeah.
Senator Coring.
Well,
Senator Coring, it's a cap on what they can.
Right, right, not, yeah. Right. But the point I'm trying to make is we're still raising the price, the copay for these folks, but we're capping it, and it's still a 300% increase to these folks versus a 1,200% increase. So I just think that your bill just makes sense. And if you talk to, and if the people that are opposed to this would actually talk to some of the folks that are affected by this, you know, even this increase that you're proposing is going to be difficult for them, but it's manageable. And I just urge my colleagues, Democrat and Republican alike, to support this bill. It's just common sense. It makes a whole lot of sense, and I'm just hoping that we can move this bill forward. So thanks.
Thank you, Senator Coring. Mr. Chair, before we get started with our testifiers here, I do want to tell a little bit of a story, a personal story, that motivated me. As some people know, I've participated in a bicycle ride that's called the Tram Ride Across Minnesota, which raises funds for multiple sclerosis. And this past year was the first time I've done it for about 8 years, but now this caps the ninth time I've actually done it, and it is something that keeps me in shape and also helps me to meet an awful lot of people. And this past year I managed to have the good fortune to be able to speak to the group up in Two Harbors, Minnesota, and I told a little bit of a story of a few people that I knew that were affected by this disease. The first is Lenny. He was my dad's best friend. My dad, whose mother died when he was young, moved into the east side of St. Paul and lived the rest of his younger years from age 8 through his teen years and graduation from high school, lived on the east side of St. Paul. And, of course, there were a lot of Swedes there at the time, so Lenny was Lenny Nelson. My dad's best friend, or other best friend, was Jim Peterson. And Jim Peterson is the Jim that I'm named after. Well, my dad always talked about Lenny, and I knew who Lenny was because when I was a young kid, we used to visit Lenny Nelson. But Lenny was in a wheelchair. Lenny couldn't speak. Lenny couldn't feed himself. Lenny was what I thought was old, but he was probably in his 40s. Lenny finally passed away when I was young, probably at an age of under 50. The next person is Harriet. Harriet is my wife's sister, was my wife's sister. She was diagnosed with MS when she was in her early 20s. Now, this was a person who was diagnosed probably in the 50s, and there weren't as many drugs and treatments at that time. Harriet didn't die from MS. She died from breast cancer incident. But she was in a wheelchair when I met her. She was in a wheelchair from her 20s and on. Now let's talk about Bob. Bob is my neighbor. Today he's 52. You can't even tell that he has MS. He's had some very good treatments. He's had the latest in pharmaceuticals that treat his drug. He rides his bicycle to work every day. He has two sons and a daughter. They're now becoming empty nesters. He's 52 years old, and he has had the treatment that has kept him working and probably will keep him working for many years. That's what we're talking about here, is a pharmaceutical that has been developed and a treatment that has come of age and is available to people to help them live long and productive lives. So what we're going to do now is we're going to make sure that this is not interfered by having a high-cost pharmaceutical. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to make sure that we carried this bill and we limited the cost to the person that's using it so that they can live a productive and long life and not have to put their funds at risk by these expensive drugs. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to turn this over to Scott Ruchim from the MS Society, and Scott will tell you more about this bill.
Thank you, Senator Carlson. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Scott Ruchim. I'm with the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, Minnesota chapter. We'd like to just offer a little bit of information for you as far as background and context for this bill. And again, we appreciate the opportunity to come before you and offer our support for Senate File 302. Beginning roughly in 2006, people with MS who are on private insurance experienced about a $25 copay for a three-month treatment supply of MS drugs. Then beginning in 2006-2007, that $25 for 3 months sharply increased to about $200 for a one-month supply of the same medication. As Senator Corrine indicated, that's about a 1,200% increase for all MS treatments. We look to bring forward Senate File 302 today in order to establish a reasonable and affordable copay amount for individuals with MS. This copay amount would affect all six MS treatments, which are currently now have a copay of $200, and we propose a copay of $50. Our hope is not to establish a cap, but to find a reasonable, affordable middle ground that our clients can still afford. As Senator Corrine indicated, it's still an increase. It's still an increase of roughly 300%. But we feel that if we can come halfway and meet the middle ground, hopefully we can establish this legislation or establish a copay amount outside of that. In respect to the committee's time, we have submitted a number of other stories and testimony, similar testimony and stories to what our testifier, Sandy McLean, will propose today. And with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. McLean.
Thank you. My name is Sandy McLean, and I was diagnosed with relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis in 1993. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to tell you why I support Senate File 302. This policy will establish a reasonably affordable copay amount for people who take MS prescription treatments. Senators, as you may know, MS is a disease of the central nervous system. People who have MS experience unpredictable symptoms that come and go without warning. Symptoms of MS include paralysis, numbness, blindness, difficulty with balance and coordination, memory problems, and extreme fatigue. While there is no cure for MS, there are FDA-approved treatments. When these treatments are taken on a continual basis, they slow the progression of the disease. Since I have been on Betaseron, one of the six MS treatments available to people with MS, my MS has not progressed, which means I have been able to live and work just like any other person my age. I'm insured by a private insurer through my employer. While covered by this insurer in 2007, I was informed that my copay for the drug Betaseron was going to increase from about $17 per month to $200. That's a 1,200% increase. Due to the sharp increase in my out-of-pocket copay for my MS treatment, I was forced to sell my home. I chose to take my medication. In making that choice, however, I was forced to give up the independence and ownership in my community that I've worked so hard for all of my life. I understand that these treatments are expensive to provide, and I am willing to pay as much as I can for my treatment, but I cannot afford a copay increase of 1,200%. I cannot afford a copay increase which devastates my budget. I cannot afford a copay increase that forces me to choose between my medication or my home, a choice I never thought I would have to make. Senate File 302 would still increase my original $17 copay to $50, which is about a 300% increase. While an increase to $50 is still steep, it's definitely more manageable than my $200 copay. That's why I hope you will support this bill so we can establish an affordable copay for MS treatments. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to address the committee and for your considering this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions from the committee. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Carlson, how much do these drugs cost per month?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, we don't have the exact cost for you right now. There's several of them, and I think there's about an 80-20 split. One of my constituents told me that it was about somewhere around $1,300 a month for him.
$1,300 a month for the medication?
Correct, yes.
And
that's just one medication, which he in particular was prescribed.
So, Senator Carlson, yeah, I understand your desire to make the amount of out-of-pocket costs for people with MS less, but who do you propose would pay the difference?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, this would be an insured difference. The insurer would pick up the difference, as they have been in the past, when it was $17 copay in his client's situation. It has been an increase that we are trying to slow and trying to maintain it only with the smaller increase instead of this large increase to $200.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Carlson, would you then be not opposed to having premiums raised for this type of policy?
Mr. Rushen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, while I understand your concern with defraying the cost over other insurers or other individuals insured in the group, the problem that we run into is all six of these MS treatments have been put into a specialty tier medication. And so while we don't look to defer the cost among anyone else, we have nowhere else to go. In the specialty tier, the medications are the copays are $200 apiece. If there was another option, if we could seek to develop a generic drug, which federal legislation prohibits us from doing, we certainly would and consider other options. But currently, our clients are pressed up against a wall. There's no other alternative, no other medications for them to try. It's the $200 copay, or it's facing the option of not taking your medication. So we understand the concern of defraying costs, but we also would appreciate the understanding of having our clients not have another option with respect to the medication.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berger.
And Mr. Rushem, have you explored other options, for instance, perhaps letting these people be in the state purchasing pool or other options to get the cost of the drugs reduced as opposed to just shifting the cost elsewhere?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, we've met with the private insurance groups over the summer to try to develop a solution to this problem outside of legislation, and we are continuing to work with them, and we hope that we can find a solution. We'd also be excited to explore any other opportunities or ideas you may have or other members of the committee may have. Ultimately, we're not looking to defray costs among other individuals. We're looking to find a solution that can help our clients. And we'd be open to other ideas if anyone wanted to come forward and propose them.
Thank you.
Mr. Rushem, I know with prescription drugs, sometimes I've seen 10 or 12 or more to one price differentials, and the health plans are negotiating, and they're getting good prices. But I had a question about the bill's intent. It describes for a drug $50 per month, and I was hearing you talk about not only that there are multiple drugs, but that many people take several of them. Is the bill's intent is to cap each one at $50, so somebody who's on three of them would be paying $150 a month?
Senator Marty, maybe that was a misunderstanding on our behalf. Currently, people with MS use one drug at a time. So if there's six different medications, their doctor may prescribe one of the medications. If at some time that there's an ambiguous result or they're not seeing the result that they want, such as the MS is further progressing, the doctor will reevaluate the situation and look to prescribe a different medication.
Thank you. We have some witnesses who want to speak against the bill, but first, Senator Lynch and then Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure who this question is directed to, but is it, do we have precedent for establishing copay amounts for particular drugs in Minnesota statute?
Senate Counsel.
Mr. Chair and Senator Lynch, there is a limit set in the rules for HMOs, not for specific drugs, but for groups of drugs, there are limits.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions, I guess. One is the $50 amount. How was that determined? What was the rationale for choosing $50 in the bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, after speaking with our clients who have expressed the increases in their copay amounts and taking into consideration their varied levels of income and what they can afford in their daily budgets, we felt that $50 was a reasonable amount that they could collectively afford. While some may be able to afford more, and we know of many that will be not able to afford this amount, we felt $50 was a reasonable amount to approach the table with.
So, Mr. Chairman, just so that we're clear, so there was an attempt to determine what the costs were of the drug and how that copay related to the cost, or to Senator Berglund's point, if you impose this, how much cost then would be increased to other participants in the plan? That was not a part of the calculation in arriving at this price. It was just sort of a chosen amount. Is that essentially correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, I would shy away from saying it was an amorphous amount that we just selected. Again, before I was with the MS Society, I know several hours of work were put into coming up with this number and talking with our clients. I also know that my predecessor worked with the private insurance groups. They may have had some influence or shed some light into why $50 was an appropriate amount that we felt that we could negotiate on. To the other side of the issue, we're unsure or unclear as to why $200 is the copay amount for the private health insurance groups. So I'm sure that they have data and information that they would like to share, and I know that we have data and information that we've used, and I'd be happy to provide that for you at some time if you are further interested.
Mr. Chairman, just I don't know what the reason for the $200 amount is either, frankly, and I guess I have the same question as how that was arrived at, but I do have a concern when we see in statute that we're going to fix a price in legislative action on a very, unsubstantiated basis. And I think that, to me, sets a precedent that I'm not sure I'm willing to do, which is to say a legislative committee can arbitrarily more or less decide a price for a treatment or a medication. And there are many who are very concerned about state government playing that kind of a role of setting prices very specifically about treatments and products when we really are not in any way prepared or able to make a determination of that. And so I guess I'm a little concerned about adopting into statute a fixed price for something when we have no idea what the cost of that product is, how it would affect other users, or how the copay that currently is in place, was it determined or any of that, and just say, well, we'll just set it at $50. That seems to me to be a little reckless. And if we're going to do something like this, which I don't think we should, but if we are, I think it would require a great deal more information about this mechanism before we did it. And Mr. Chairman, you might have some other testifiers that could shed light on that.
Chair Marty, Senator Hahn, due to some recent information I was just handed, $25 was an average copay amount over the 3 months. We've taken the $25 and the $200 now, that is the 1 month, and tried to find, we multiplied it and then tried to find a middle ground, and that ended up being $50 a month. So there was a mathematical formula in order to determine this amount.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate the mathematics. That doesn't mean that there's any logic behind it. I mean, doing math is just doing math, but there should be some rationale for why that math was applied. And I do have a question of why that copay has gone up and what was the basis for that. And if there is a good, reasonable basis for that, then we ought to know that before we arbitrarily say, no, we're not going to do that. And I don't know what that is. That's my point. And I just think it's bad precedent for us as a committee to just sort of come in and say, well, we're going to set the price, even though we have very little knowledge of why the price is what it is and what the mechanisms are that would determine that price. So unless, Mr. Chairman, there's other information that can be brought, I'm not sure we should take this up.
Mr. Hahn, there are two witnesses who wish to speak in three witnesses who wish to speak in opposition to the bill. Maybe we'll take them now.
Mr. Chair, may I respond to this?
Yes, Senator Pittner, so on.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Hahn and others, I can appreciate the concern you have. I also appreciate Senator Berglund's concern about the cost of this drug being passed on to other insured. And I don't think that it's even in the hands of the insureds. I think it's in the hands of the drug manufacturers who have a monopoly on the delivery of this drug, and we don't have any way of finding out what their average manufacturing price is or what their best price is. And so we have no way of knowing exactly what the actual copay should be on this drug or what the actual cost of producing the drug is. And until we're able to gain that information, I think that we get a very skewed request, and they are going to whop us for whatever we can give them or whatever we're willing to pay for the drug. And so I can appreciate the barriers that you're up against in this situation.
Senator Pittner, so on that issue, we do have legislation we'll be considering soon on pharmacy benefit managers for price disclosure, so we will be able to get that if we can pass that.
Mr. Chair, I have a bill, too.
Good. Let's have the witnesses in opposition to the bill now. And I would ask people to try and be quick, because Senator Murphy has some time limits on his being here, and I want to get moving on his bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Barsh. I represent Health Partners. I'm also here today on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, which represents Minnesota's 8 nonprofit health plans. We are here today in opposition to Senate File 302. Because of the restriction it places on our ability to work with purchasers to find an affordable product that meets their needs. As the testifiers before mentioned, this bill was brought forward in reaction to products that are currently available and sold in the marketplace. About a third of our products have a pharmacy benefit with a fourth tier, and I'll discuss that in a second. the legislation is response to this new pharmacy benefit. In addition to what is a traditional tiered benefit that most of us are familiar with, where there's a certain copay for generic drugs, brand name drugs, and potentially off-formulary drugs, a lot of new products have what's called a fourth tier for a class of drugs called biologics. And I'm going to talk about biologics as they apply to all conditions, not just MS, because there are a number of conditions that these drugs can be used for, and they provide tremendous benefit to the people who use them. But this fourth benefit generally applies a coinsurance to the cost of this drug, 20% of the cost of the drug, with a maximum payment of $200. That's the usual product design. You've mentioned the $200 limit here today. The development of this new benefit, as I mentioned, was in response to these biologics, which are new class, and quite frankly, they are often referred to as miracle drugs because they are. It's amazing what they can do in terms of improving the lives of the patients who use them. There's no debate in this discussion about the evidence or effectiveness of these treatments. We know they work. We know they're great. And as I mentioned, we know they're invaluable to the patients, but we also know they're incredibly expensive, and the growth in their utilization is tremendous. And just some numbers, biologics account for 0.35% of health partners' prescriptions, but that 0.35% accounts for 11% of our total pharmacy costs. Our growth in biologic drug trend between 2003 and 2007 was 101%. We expect that to grow higher as more of these drugs are being produced by manufacturers. The average cost for a biological drug for us in 2008 was $1,700. That's a 12% increase over the previous year. For MS drugs, the average cost was $1,900, and that includes four of the six examples that were brought here before. You know, if you look back historically, prescription drugs were a key driver of healthcare cost increase in the 90s, but there was a lot of work done by purchasers, health plans, consumers, and policymakers to drive that trend down. And we're lucky now that non-biological drugs account for only about 1% of the overall increase. But biologics are making up for that at a rapid, rapid pace. And one of the things that was mentioned here, the biggest reason for that is there is no ability to develop generic versions of these drugs. It's prohibited under federal law. There's been movement out in Washington, D.C. to create a pathway to develop generic versions of these drugs, something that we strongly support. In contrast to the biogenerics, average cost for a cholesterol agent now is $46 a month. There again, you see the evidence of where this has gone. So really what we're talking about today, and it's something the committee already discussed, is the discussion about what's an expense we can expect an individual to contribute for their condition or for their treatment, and what's an expense that we can expect the rest of the population to insure. And that is not an easy discussion, and it's even less easy when you look at the benefit that these treatments can provide to the patients who use them. If you have employer-sponsored coverage, the amount that you might pay for your premium or your deductible or your copay or coinsurance can vary based on the discussion that your employer has had with your insurer. Is it more or less fair for someone who to pay a $100 emergency room visit than someone who pays a $30 office visit? When you look at the expense of those two procedures, who's paying more or less for that treatment? Is it more or less fair for someone to pay $30 for a copay for a drug that costs $50, or for someone to pay $200 for a drug that costs $1,900? Those aren't easy discussions to have, but they're discussions that we have with employers and purchasers when we're trying to put together a benefit package that they can afford, that can meet the health needs of their employees, and that can still be affordable again enough where they purchase it. The questions we have are the questions we've raised here. Is $50 an appropriate maximum to put into law? Senate Council referenced state rule creates a formula for limits on co-payments for HMOs. I don't know of any other instance where statute puts a dollar amount limit on any drug. Is the $50 limit appropriate for MS drugs or for all biologic drugs? Should a $50 limit be applied to other services? ER copays are commonly $100 now. That's acceptable. The question is this an acceptable limit to put in for this condition? We think no. We think these are difficult questions, but ones that are answered best when purchasers and consumers and health plans work together to try and find as close to that comfort point as they can between affordability and meeting the health needs. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any other questions that the committee has.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Just a question to kind of pick up from the discussion we were having before. If this were to pass, why wouldn't it then be feasible for the health plans to say, okay, we'll just go to the drug manufacturers and say we're just going to pay less because we don't want to spread the cost around to other insurers, and presumably you're charging an excessive amount. So why could you not do that and just say we're going to assume that the additional cost increase is being driven by some mechanism that the drug manufacturer has, and it's arbitrary and unfair, so let's just make them reduce their cost? Why couldn't you do that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, first, that's something we already try to do. We don't negotiate with drug companies in an attempt to raise the cost of the prescriptions. In fact, we try to negotiate very hard to bring the cost of those drugs down. But as was mentioned earlier, particularly with these biologic agents, they are there's a monopoly in who's producing these and what the agents are. The manufacturers have tremendous control and authority over what the price of these drugs are. And to the extent that we can, we do try to bring that cost down, but we're limited, just like everyone else is, through the size and the market forces that are at play.
And Mr. Chairman, and just to kind of so basically what you're saying is that you're doing that aggressively right now, and this and what we have today is a reflection of that. And if you insisted on just a $50 amount, that the response would likely be, sorry, we're not going to sell them to you. Is that essentially their answer? If you said that was the upper limit we're going to go, they'd say, well, okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, if we tried to tell them that we're only paying $50 for the drug, they'd say you can go try to purchase them from someone else. The effect would be we would be limited in what we could charge the individual, and we'd spread that cost over our other premium payers.
And Mr. Chairman, just I wanted to also go back to your comment about the that there is apparently some federal law that prohibits the development of generic treatments of these biologics, and you described it as a monopoly. Is it a monopoly, or is this a result of patented products that have a certain lifespan that once they, as long as they're in that lifespan, that they are protected from being copied? And is that what we're dealing with here? I mean, I've heard and read that there are often drugs that are developed at great expense over a long period of time, and they have a limited window of opportunity to recover the cost for that research. It's 20 years or something. And is that what we're faced with here, or is it something else?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hahn, biologics are a whole new entity. They're a whole new classification of drug. So the common pathway for a drug to develop into a generic is not in play here. Usually that patent protection is in place after which generics can be developed. There is no pathway recognized by the FDA, and this is my understanding, for the development of generic biological drugs. That's the issue at hand. So there's no point in the future at which these a generic version will be available for any of these drugs unless Congress forces the FDA to create that pathway. And that's something that's been supported by, I believe, at least 100, if not 200 organizations at the federal level, opposed by two, and you can probably guess who those two are.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that. And I guess what I'm trying to get at, though, the issue here is the protection of intellectual property, and there is a debate, and I think a legitimate one, about to what extent that intellectual property can be protected. But if we set the standard that intellectual property cannot be protected, then is there not some harm in that kind of regimen if we say, well, you can spend all the time and effort to develop these things, but once you do, anybody can copy them? Isn't there some harm in that as well? So what I'm getting at is that there likely will be some resolution to this at the federal level, but it probably won't be an abandonment of the idea that there's some protection that ought to be given to people, individuals, and companies that spend a lot of time and effort to develop products that are useful, but they also want to expect to be able to recover costs and profit by that as well. Is that fair to kind of describe it in that way?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, I believe the action at the federal level is to copy the process for other pharmaceuticals, which, for those who are concerned about it, may provide that opportunity for protection for those who develop intellectual property. Our concern is more about the end user. We've seen the development of generic drugs have a tremendous ability to reduce the cost of treatment for people who need drugs, and we'd like to see that in place for biologics as well.
Thank you. Mr. Hickey.
Mr. Chairman, members, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. We're the state's largest business group in terms of entities, with over 13,000 members, all small, and with a significant member base in every one of your districts. I'm hardly an expert on the ins and outs of the complexities of pharmaceutical drugs, and it's something small business struggles with as much as anyone else, and this is certainly a dire problem and that I've had firsthand experience with. But our concern here is this is another mandate we're trying to do, and we're seeing a long list of these this year, and people have to realize we're reaching hardly anyone with mandates currently. The latest analysis by the Minnesota Department of Health shows that only 27% of the private market is being affected or touched by these mandates. You know, and the question I need to pose is, you know, when are we going to stop doing this? This used to be 50-60%. I was talking to a colleague of mine years ago. He started in 1991. It was 60%. He worked for a major insurer, and the big concern is when are we going to slip below 50? We're at 27%, meaning 73% of the people in the private market in this state, which includes a lot of government workers, aren't touched by anything you do. And at what point we just got to quit doing this because we realize we're really not accomplishing what we think we're accomplishing. Additionally, we're putting new burdens. I don't know the exact cost impact of this bill. We're concerned about it, and hopefully we'll learn it over time. But this is a burden you're really putting only on small employers and individuals. You're not touching the largest, richest companies in this state. And at some point, I think we just got to look for better solutions. And a lot of them probably are federal-based about you know, what states can do and can't do and who's in the federal ERISA market. But it's a growing market, the federal ERISA market. The state-regulated market is a shrinking market. And so, you know, each one of these, some of them don't cost much. We don't know about this one. The cost implications sound pretty serious to me, despite how dire the problem is. But you're reaching almost no one. You're putting the burden on the people who can least afford it. And, you know, small employers are being priced out of the market. But we all know that most uninsurance in the private sector is with companies less than 10, less than 20. And each one of these mandates is just a step in the wrong direction to making a policy more affordable for a small employer. And so I just urge you to really tread with caution here. Know what you're doing. Know how much you're raising premiums on small employers and individuals especially. And we're just very concerned about this bill and several other ones we've seen this year. And thanks for the time.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. Questions from the committee? Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess this is a general question. How many biologic drugs are there?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, I don't know that off the top of my head, but it's something I can get an
It's more than these.
Yes. The biologics are produced for a number of conditions in addition to multiple sclerosis.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Johnson.
I had a brief discussion with Senator Lurie, and he thought the same thing. But why can't this bill then be crafted for all kinds? I mean, we're going to see a proliferation of this type of legislation if we do this for multiple sclerosis in these six, won't we?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, that's a concern we have.
Senator Johnson, and several people were talking about earlier about setting co-payments in statute. We already do that for medical assistance at $3. We're not setting the price, we're setting the co-pay, and that's what this bill would do, too. So it's not like it's not been done before. And the other point, when talking about who's paying the cost of this, I keep thinking, you know, I know lots of people. My wife had cancer. I know lots of people have had cancer who have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of stuff. And I don't have cancer, and I'm paying for it. Is that the way we want to get, where we're going to each pay for our own sickness? We don't need insurance for that. I mean, I think that's what the question is. I've talked to so many people. I know they've been trying for the last couple of years to negotiate this, but MS people, a lot of them don't have a lot of income, and I think you read some of these stories about people who stop taking the drugs because they can't afford it. I don't think this bill solves the whole problem, but I think it's recognizing there is a problem out there. Senator Johnson.
But, Mr. Chair, that's kind of my point, though, too, is there's other long-term debilitating diseases that if we're going to do this for one, we got to do it for all of them or stick with where we're at now.
Senator... wants to be recognized. Nobody. Do we have Senator Carlson?
Was there a question on the table? I'm sorry.
No, there was not. I was just asking you if you had any response or comments to any of the discussion.
Well, one thing that I was thinking about is that the issue with this particular treatment is that it is for a chronic illness. This illness does not get better. This treatment does keep a person working for a longer period of time. It's not the same as some treatments. So some treatments that might be short term, and then the person recovers and stops taking the drug. These drugs are for life. So there is a difference there in that this is a cumulative. You're going to be taking it every month for the rest of your life. So there is a little bit of a thought process there that goes into a chronic illness that's different than an acute illness.
Senator Pretner-Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Carlson, do you have any idea how many people this would affect if this legislation were passed? I'm wondering how many people are already disabled and on Medicare or some other type of public program.
Mr. Risham.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pretner-Solon, currently we believe that there's around 9,000 people in Minnesota affected with MS, but that's just the individuals who choose to come forward and let us know about the disease. It could range anywhere from 10,000 to 12,000. And we also have individuals who have not been diagnosed yet. MS is a disease where one day you may wake up with blurred vision or numbness in an arm, and you dismiss it as you're having a bad day. It goes undiagnosed very frequently. So moving forward, as we try to reach out to communities and reach out to individuals to be checking for MS, that number is only going to increase.
But, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering how many people have other options for coverage of the drugs that are under consideration here and would not have a copay.
Mr. Chair.
Or would have a limited copay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pretner-Solon, I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question. There are no other options. So of that group that I was describing, of that class of individuals, there are no other treatment options. These six...
No. Mr. Chair, maybe I'm not making my clear. I'm wondering how many of them are determined disabled and under Medicare benefits or some other type of public program in which there would not be as steep a copay for it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pretner-Solon, I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question. About a third are covered by government programs.
Okay. I suppose if we don't cover them, their disease will progress for a lot of people and we'll have a lot more covered.
Correct. Mr. Chair, I mean, our hope is to ensure that as many people stay off as government programs as possible, to stay working, to stay active members of their family, to stay within their communities. By taking the medication on a continuous basis, we feel we can do that. However, intermittent medication or stopping medication completely will only increase the problem.
Further discussion. Is there anyone who wants to make a motion? Senator Torres-Ray will move Senate File 302, it's not amended, as be recommended pass referred to the Committee on Commerce. Is there more discussion on that motion? Not all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
No. Aye.
Motion does not prevail. Thank you, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Senator Murphy, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chairman, hopefully we have a little better success than Senator Carlson did. Mr. Chairman and committee members, to my left is Ms. Ossie. She's been working with all the stakeholders to help craft this piece of legislation. And she is a professional attorney and, in my opinion, has done a very good job of making sure that this bill is in the order that we need it to get passed. Now, with that said, evidently there must be a technical amendment that the chairman has, and when he gets back, I'll let him offer it up.
I'll move adoption of the amendment.
Thank you, Senator Berglund. Moves the amendment. I don't have it in front of me. Excuse me, Senator. I'm just trying to get to it. I think it's the A1 amendment. Is that correct, Senator Murphy?
Yes, Madam Chairwoman. And it's just strictly a technical amendment.
Any questions about the amendment? If not, all of those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Please continue.
Thank you,
Senator
Madam
Chair.
Madam Chair and members, Senate File 97 is a bill which this committee heard last year. It deals with medicinal marijuana and hopefully instituting a program here in Minnesota that would be that had been done in 13 other states here in the United States and would allow people who are in the end-of-life issues and chronic and serious pain the ability to use medicinal marijuana. We've got a lot of testifiers that are both for and against this bill. And as I said, this committee's heard this issue before, so I'm not going to spend too much time because the bill actually has not changed substantially. But members, in a day and age when there's an over 2-to-1 margin that supports something here in Minnesota, we need to set up and pay attention. In Minnesota, actually, the number is higher than 2-to-1. 2-to-1 is what it is on a national basis, as a poll conducted by USA Today. I mentioned that it's already the law of the land in 13 states. And members, this is bipartisan. Senator Johnson was at the press conference that we had earlier today. Thank you, Senator Lori, and many other people. The former representative, Mr. De La Forest, is heading up this legislative effort. And we also have Senator Coring and Senator Michelle have either been co-authors or authors of this legislation or have supported it wholeheartedly. So it is a bipartisan plan. Members, this bill is very easy to understand. If you look at page 1, it talks about some of the definitions that go on and how much usable marijuana you can actually have, and it's 2.5 ounces. Page 2, some of the highlights. It talks about the debilitating medical conditions that this committee has jurisdiction over. It also talks, it gives a definition on practitioner and primary caregiver. As we know, the practitioner has to be a licensed doctor in the state of Minnesota that would issue a certificate saying that the individual in the individual under his care, he's recommending that they use medicinal marijuana. The primary caregiver is defined there, and that's just the person who is going to acquire the medicinal marijuana for the patient's use. On the next page, it talks about a qualifying patient. It also talks about the registry identification card. Folks, we've really tightened up on the issue of who can get a registry card, who the patients are. Goes down a little bit further. It talks about the protections for either a primary caregiver or a qualified patient, and also for the folks who are actually going to grow a registered organization. And the registered organization is defined on page 11. A couple other things in the bill that were of note last year on page 5, it talks about the caregiver reimbursement. There was a lot of discussion in regards to are these caregivers going to hijack the process and overcharge. It simply states in there that they can only get reimbursed for their costs. A little bit further down, another issue was nursing facilities. This bill outlines what nursing facilities can do, and it's pretty clear they may adopt reasonable restrictions on the use, which means that they can designate a place where they can use it and things like that. If you go to the next page, it starts about the requirements for the issuance of the registration cards, and I believe another item of interest was on page 8, and that is what happens with lost cards and what the process is for getting a new card. Other than that, on page 9, it starts about construction, about where people can actually use medicinal marijuana. We had a lot of discussions in this committee and other committees about, well, we don't want a school bus driver to use it or anybody on school grounds or anybody in a correctional facility. So that's all outlined there. It also states very clearly that you can't operate planes, trains, automobiles, anything that's going to move and damage anybody else while using medicinal marijuana. On page 11, once again, it talks about the registered organization, the definition there, and I believe the rest of it deals with some background checks. Once again, everybody that's involved in this, registered organization, has to undergo a very extensive background check. And, if you look at page 14, it talks about if anybody can't pass that background check, they're immediately dismissed from the program. I think this is a very good bill, members, and if you have any questions about the bill, either myself or Ms. Ossie can answer those for you, but I think it's more important that you hear from the people who would be most affected by this and would ask that, our list of testifiers come to the table now, and that's Mr. Wagner, Ms. Whitting, and Mrs. Rippenthorpe.
Welcome to the committee. Doctor, you want to go first, or do you want to go first?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Dr. George Wagoner. I'm a graduate of the University of Michigan Medical School and a fellow of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. I practiced obstetrics and gynecology for nearly 30 years. The first year in Virginia, Minnesota. I'm here today to speak on behalf of Senate File 97, the medical marijuana bill. Until 2 years ago, I had no experience with marijuana and could not even identify it by smell. My wife of 51 years was diagnosed with stage 4 ovarian carcinoma in early February of 2007. She had 2 surgeries and 3 courses of chemotherapy and died on July 15th, 2007. Her most distressing symptom was nausea and vomiting with each course of chemotherapy. Her nausea was only slightly diminished with the usual antiemetic medications, including Zofran, a drug commonly prescribed for chemotherapy patients at 4-hour intervals and $46 per dose. I had heard anecdotally for years that marijuana was singularly effective for the nausea associated with chemotherapy. Consequently, we consulted our family physician. He said he couldn't prescribe marijuana, but could give her a prescription for Marinol, synthetic THC, one of 60 chemical compounds that can be isolated from marijuana. I had the prescription filled and my wife took the pills. Her nausea was slightly relieved after the first pill. But after the second one, she saw a severed head sitting on a rock outside our dining room window and realized she was hallucinating and refused to take any more. In desperation, I told all my acquaintances that if I could obtain some marijuana, we'd like to try it. The plastic bag containing a small amount of marijuana mysteriously appeared in my kitchen the next day. It was a Sunday, and we didn't know how to use it. I made marijuana tea, and she threw it up. She couldn't eat anything, so I couldn't bake brownies. I was unable to find a pipe for sale in my small town in Michigan. And so that afternoon, I made one out of some scraps in my workshop. Put a small amount of marijuana in the bowl, just a pinch, and lit it. The stem was a plastic straw. With the second inhalation of smoke, my dear wife experienced sudden and complete relief of her nausea. It lasted 4 to 6 hours and was repeatable. She later used a vaporizer that required about 6 breaths, but was much more acceptable to my non-smoking wife. The relief was as complete and as dramatic as any I've experienced in all my practice of medicine. Eating lunch is not a big deal until you can't. The benefits of the medicinal use of marijuana are well documented. November of 2008, my home state of Michigan became the 13th state to approve the medical use of marijuana. Physicians should be able to write a prescription for the medical use of marijuana, and pharmacists ought to be able to fill it. But until federal law changes to allow such a system, the medical marijuana bill that appears before you, much like the popular laws now working well in 13 states, is the best alternative. The recommended patient should be able to choose a medicine that works best for them with a recommendation of their doctor, without fear of arrest or jail. And that is precisely what this bill will allow. Keeping medical marijuana away from sick people in this situation is unconscionable. Minnesota can and should do better. Thank you for hearing me.
Thank you, Dr. Wagner. Ms. Whiting?
Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. My name is Joni Whiting, and I appreciate the opportunity to tell my story. However, I want to be clear from the outset. There's nothing being done here in this room today that will benefit my family or me. There is nothing you can give to ease our pain. I will suffer for the rest of my life for what I have lost. I am here today only to tell you about a woman I loved and lost 6 years ago. I ask only that you listen to her story, to walk just briefly in her shoes and mine. My daughter Stephanie was a wife, a loving mother of three, and a beloved employee of Dart Distributing. Stephanie had a unique and beautiful voice, the voice of an angel. In June of 2000, at 24 years of age, Stephanie was diagnosed with melanoma skin cancer on her face. A mole had gone bad during her pregnancy, and it was already too late. The next 2 years were filled with experimental therapies and endless surgeries as they cut her face off, 1 inch at a time, until there was nothing left to cut. There was nothing left to cover the hole in her face. All but 4 of her teeth had been removed due to the side effects of her chemotherapy, and her skin grafts had failed. It was difficult for her to eat. The nausea was so severe that the medications gave her little, if any, relief. A doctor at the hospital pulled me aside and told me that she may get some relief from smoking marijuana. But that wasn't an acceptable option for me or her, being drug-free. In addition, the legal ramifications associated with illegal use was frightening. After her 10th surgery,
All efforts to save her life had failed, and her oncologist predicted that she had about 6 months to live. At that time, she was taking approximately 40 to 50 OxyContins, tablets of OxyContins, and 30 to 40 tablets of Roxycodone per day. Yet her pain was still evident in every breath she took and in her every movement. Her whole body was racked with continuous and uncontrollable pain, and her tumors continued to grow. There was nothing to stop it, nothing to slow it down, and the hope for a miracle faded as my child bravely began to make the plans for the ending of her life. When Zofran, the anti-nausea drug, continued to give her no relief, Stephanie began to lose weight. We asked her doctor to prescribe Marinol, a synthetic version of THC, one of the active chemical compounds in marijuana, but even taking this in pill form didn't abate any of her symptoms, and she stopped taking it because it didn't work. As her tumors grew larger, it became more and more difficult for her to eat. They were growing outside and inside of her mouth, her throat, and her chest. My other adult children begged me to let her use marijuana, and when I refused, they took her out of my home. When she came back 3 days later, Stephanie told me she'd gotten hungry after using it, and that the marijuana had kicked up her appetite, as well as allowed her to keep the food down. She had eaten 3 meals a day at a time when she'd routinely eaten nothing for days. She had just a touch of energy back, and she looked better than I had seen her in months. For reasons I don't know, marijuana also enhanced the effects of Stephanie's pain medication and didn't make her appear high. My only regret is not allowing her to use marijuana in my home throughout her illness. Yet the fear of being caught was significant. I called several of my family members and friends of our family and asked if they knew of anywhere we could purchase marijuana. The next morning, someone had placed a package of it on our doorstep. I have never known who to thank for it, but I remain grateful beyond belief. I was prepared to defend my daughter's use to anyone who asked. In retrospect, I can tell you with conviction that I would have no problem going to jail for acquiring medical marijuana for my suffering child. The law is unjust, and I would rather spend the rest of my life in prison than to have denied her the medicine that kept her pain at bay and allowed her to live 89 more days. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, I quote, "I submit that an individual who breaks a law that conscience tells him is unjust and who willingly accepts the penalty of imprisonment in order to arouse the conscience of the community over its injustice is in reality expressing the highest respect for the law," unquote. I'm here today to tell you I am no longer willing to support making criminals out of the sick and dying. I saw with my own eyes that medical marijuana worked. I have dedicated a large portion of my own life to helping people stay clean and drug-free, and I see no contradiction in this at all. My daughter was able to eat for nearly 3 more months because of marijuana. I allowed her to use it in my home before meals because it worked and helped her, and every day of her life was precious to her and her 3 small children. We had Thanksgiving and Christmas with her at the table that year. Having her there was priceless. Shortly after Stephanie was placed on 24-hour nursing care and could no longer use medical marijuana, her pain was so severe that when she asked my husband and me to lie down on both sides of her and hold her, she couldn't stand the pain of us touching her. She was on IV morphine and moaned in pain continuously. Her hospice nurses were so disturbed by the severity of her pain that they finally used IV lidocaine to numb her whole body. The morphine, even at the strongest dose allowed by law, wasn't giving her any relief. On January 14th, 2003, at 1:30 in the morning, her beloved children sleeping in their beds in other rooms, Stephanie died in the room she grew up in, holding my hand. Her strong heart continued to beat for nearly 3 minutes. She was 26 years old. They say there's no greater loss than a child for a parent. They're right. For this government to deny those who need medical marijuana to lessen the severity of their pain, nausea, and seizures is unjustifiable. To threaten the sick and dying and their loved ones with jail, unconscionable. I'm a Vietnam veteran, and my youngest son has recently returned from 18 months in Iraq. We are a family that honors this country, having served it in the military in every conflict since the Revolutionary War. I don't use drugs. I don't abuse alcohol. I've raised 4 children. I'm currently raising the children my daughter had to leave behind. What would you have done had you been in my shoes? Could you sleep at night when your child is screaming in pain? What price would you be willing to pay to relieve the suffering of someone you love? The fact is, you can't do anything for me. But there are others in similar situations right now in Minnesota. They deserve compassion, dignity, and honor, and you can provide some amount of relief to them by passing this bill. I would like to share with you my daughter.
We'll pass it around.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Ms. Rippentrop.
Hi. Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Kathy Rippentrop, and I appreciate the opportunity to submit my testimony in support of the medical marijuana bill today. My mother, Jane Schmidt, was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer in November of 2003 and was given about 1 year to live. Mom went through many surgeries and many hospitals. She had a section of her colon removed and then the right half of her liver. A year later, they removed more of her liver and later part of her lung, part of her diaphragm, and a large glob of cancer that had wrapped around her main blood vessel that fed her lower torso. She also caught MRSA, a flesh-eating virus, while in the hospital, and recovering from each surgery became more complicated. Mom tolerated the first series of chemo quite well. However, the pills she was prescribed for the vomiting cost $100 each. They were only about 75% effective. They took 30 minutes to start working and were not covered by insurance. And they did nothing at all for her dwindling appetite. Another surgery and a second series of chemo took its toll. Mom was withering away to nothing with no appetite, suffered serious stomach sickness, and found it extremely hard to stay in a positive frame of mind. That's when a friend of my dad suggested he buy a bag of marijuana. My dad is a recovering alcoholic and drug user, 30 years clean, and was highly reluctant to bring an illegal substance into the house. But after watching Mom suffer for another few days, he had the friend procure some. My family will tell you that the only miracle drug for cancer is marijuana. 2 puffs, 2 minutes, and the violent sickness is totally gone. An hour later, my mom was able to have a good meal.
The stomach problems from the chemo were totally gone. It also helped her regain a quality of life that allowed her to continue to fight. Unless you're dying yourself or very close to someone that is, it's extremely hard to imagine how depressing a debilitating illness can be. Dying is bad, but dying in sickness and pain is much worse. Mom ended up living for 4.5 years. She would have never survived the second year without medical marijuana. With it, she was able to keep fighting and was even able to travel overseas before the end. In the 12 months before she died, she visited Israel, Jordan, Egypt, Mexico, Cuba, and Greece. These were all lifelong dreams that she was able to fulfill only because of medical marijuana. My father will tell you how ironic it is that the government should worry that a murderer might feel some pain, yet make the only good cancer drug against the law. He likes to say that when they or their spouse or their child has cancer, those that are so against it will become believers in a real hurry. When a loved one is suffering, you do whatever you can do to ease their pain. There's simply no reason that this safe, effective medicine should not be available to those who need it. I strongly urge the committee to support this compassionate legislation.
Thank you, Ms. Ripentrop, and all of you for your testimony. Senator Pretner-Solan.
Mr. Chair, and all of you who testified, thank you very much. I know that this was difficult for you. It was difficult for us to hear your stories. And I can appreciate, especially Ms. Whiting, your story. My husband also died of malignant melanoma 7 years ago. And he was my predecessor here in the Senate and sat here for 31 years and chaired this committee, actually, for a number of years. And he was a recovering alcoholic, and he remained entirely too stoic and refused to use the marijuana, and so I watched him suffer tremendously, especially the last 4 months of his life.
Absolutely.
Dr. Wagoner, I sit on the oncology team. I'm a psychologist and sit on an oncology team. And the doctors that I work with every year ask me when I come back, when are we going to pass that marijuana bill? And there's always a patient that needs that marijuana. And the most recent one was that the Marinol, first of all, doesn't seem to work. But the last person that they questioned me about had to pay over $1,000 for his prescription. And they said it's just not sustainable. It's impossible. So I appreciate your testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you all. We have several witnesses who wish to speak with concerns about the bill or opposition to the bill. Harlan Johnson, Jim Freeling, I'll pull two at a time, maybe, or three at a time, and Ryan Rasmussen.
As fast as I can.
Welcome to the committee. While you begin,
Mr. Chair, my name is Harlan Johnson, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. And I'm here representing not only the Chiefs of Police of Minnesota, but also sheriffs and all of law enforcement from Minnesota. We have formed a coalition about this topic, and usually we are fractured with management and labor. In this case, we are not. Law enforcement in Minnesota is sympathetic for those who are suffering from chronic pain, and we don't want to cause any greater grief to anyone. Likewise, we're sympathetic to the families who also have suffered when their loved ones are using or abusing controlled substances. Our mission has always been to protect and to serve, and to protect our citizens from harm from others and maybe sometimes from themselves. So you're wondering, why am I here? We're here to restate our position that we stand firm in our continued public safety opposition to a bill that allow medical or any legalized use of marijuana. We're not healthcare professionals. We don't profess to be. But we do rely on those agencies that are, like the FDA, an agency whose sole purpose is to allow only safe and effective drugs to be used by our citizens, our Minnesota citizens. We believe that getting FDA approval first assures purity, proper dosage, delivery, price control, and transparency of sales to provide safeguards against abuse. Using legislation to authorize medical use of marijuana bypasses research and scientific testing to assure these safeguards. We often point to the California model for legalized medical use of marijuana, and others would say it wouldn't happen in Minnesota because this law is more tightly written. Maybe so, but once the toothpaste is out of the tube, it's very difficult to get back in. And as I stated, my reason for being here is to restate our position in opposition to legalized marijuana. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Freeland.
Yeah, my name is James Freeland. I'm 37 years old from St. Paul. I started using drugs at 12 years old when my sister introduced me to marijuana. I started smoking weed for a number of years every day. I started selling marijuana when I was 13 to other kids. This continued to my junior and senior high school. The use of marijuana took a toll on my grades. Before I started using marijuana, I had very good grades. I started smoking it, and my grades fell to a point where I barely passed high school. And my college dreams were all but gone. I tried to quit smoking marijuana numerous times over the years with no luck. After a while, I got into stronger drugs, ones that I said I'd never use. Over the next 23 years, I've used and sold a lot of drugs, marijuana being a major part of that. I currently have 3 first-degree narcotic sales on my record. I've been in a long-term treatment program for 11 months. I was sentenced to treatment and served 12 years in prison. I've already served a 90-month sentence for drug sales, so I have a lot of experience in the illegal drug trade. When I heard of this proposal, my criminal mind started turning. I see it this way. First, whoever is allowed to grow marijuana will be supplying me. I don't see how you can keep this out of drug dealers' hands. When I started selling drugs, the brass ring was to find a marijuana grower. If you knew someone who would grow good pot, you could write your own ticket. I could offer the person growing the marijuana either drugs or more money than they would ever get selling it to patients. If the grower agrees, then I'm in business. But if he refuses, that's okay too. Here's what would happen then. A few days later, his door would be kicked in, and a few guys with guns and masks would take the plants. This is already happening in California. There's too much money to be made off of those plants for this not to happen. There's a high demand for marijuana in the street. People would do anything to make the money that meeting this demand would bring. Now, you may think that you can regulate the growing part, and maybe you can, but I will still get it. Here's how. If I know someone who has a prescription for this marijuana, I will simply offer them different drugs or money for it. Trust me, people will sell it to me. Of that, I have no doubt. So you see, all this will do is make the job of a drug dealer a lot easier. In closing, I wish that you would reconsider what this proposal will actually do to the people of Minnesota and their children. I'd like to state that marijuana is addictive. It is a gateway drug. I'm proof of that. Legalizing it is only going to increase crime and lead to more abuse. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rasmussen.
Yes, my name is Ryan Rasmussen. I'm 28 years old. Growing up for me, my father was a drug dealer. He grew marijuana, and he told me at a time he drove from Florida to Minnesota with over 500 pounds in a vehicle. And me and my father were in that vehicle, or me and my brother were in that vehicle. Growing up, it was in my house and smoked in front of me. When my uncle would babysit me, I'd go with him to his house or a friend's house, and I was introduced of growing marijuana. Just by seeing it. I was around 8 years old seeing bright lights, mirrors, fans, and green plants. As I got into high school, I learned how to grow marijuana, learning how to clone and graft plants. By grafting and cloning plants, generations of them would strengthen the higher THC levels in that plant. I learned to use oxygen to strengthen the THC levels in that plant, what would impair your vision and thinking. 2 ounces is a very large amount with which they're going against. And I've been caught with 2 ounces by the police, and they asked me, who am I selling this to? I see marijuana as a gateway drug. I've seen thousands of kids use it and get into other drugs. I pretty soon found myself using crystal meth. Pot would make me lazy and make me paranoid. I then was trading my weed for meth. At this time, I was carrying guns. By making this legal, I know a lot more would be using marijuana in Minnesota. In high school, the effects of marijuana that had on me, I'd read a chapter and wouldn't even be able to tell you what the chapter was about, and I'd just tell you the last sentence of that paragraph. My mind was always wandering off. Marijuana is a very addictive and potent drug. It is illegal for a reason. At times, when I have children, I do not want them to not let them know that marijuana can be legalized by getting it medically or just to teach them that it is not right to smoke it. I hope this bill does not get passed. I have a stepfather that's in the hospital right now that's dying. And my life goes out to those that are very hurt and ill. Growing up, I was a great athlete, and I had dreams of playing professional sports. And marijuana took all those dreams from me. And today, I fight facing treatment and treatments just to get away from this. In my conclusion, I just want to let you know pot is a gateway drug. Pot is very addictive, and it severely impairs judgment and reaction to driving or wherever. Pot just don't affect other people, yourself, but it affects other people, not just the user. Legalizing medical pot will cause more crime, not less crime. And I thank you all for listening.
Mr. Johnson, I had a question for you. We just had testimony from two people who have said they abuse drugs and talking about legalizing marijuana. And I know if we legalized it, it might, like tobacco, which is more addictive and more deadly. I know nobody's asking for that, though. My question is, with one of the previous witnesses talked about her daughter taking OxyContin and so on. Those are very, very addictive drugs as well. And they could be abused, too. And I think they are abused, too. As a police chiefs, do they think that should be illegal, too, because it's could be abused and people do abuse it?
Mr. Chair, no, we don't believe that should be made illegal also. I heard that testimony also and talked about 60 to 80 drugs a day, pills a day. And I think that, like I say, we're not health professionals, but, you know, in my limited knowledge, that seems like a lot of pills to be prescribed to an individual on a daily basis. But
Mr. Chair, I can attest that it is prescribed. My husband was prescribed that amount in order to alleviate the pain and that he was experiencing. And he didn't take as much as he could have taken. It could have been much more. And it is highly addictive, though.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
That in itself is an entire discussion. Oxycodone and OxyContin, when they have those time-release mechanisms in them and teenagers are using them, they're not getting high off the first and the second pill. By the third and fourth pill, they have a lethal dose in them, and they don't even know it. Marijuana, there is no lethal dose.
I've always wondered why the distinction with other drugs that are abused, why those are okay to have, but this one isn't. But is there further questions from the committee?
Well, and Mr. Chair.
Sarah Prettner-Solon.
We're talking about end-of-life issues. We're not talking about getting people hooked on drugs and then going out in the street and destroying their lives or passing it on to other people. We're talking about end-of-life issues, a last resort for people suffering.
Senator Torres, right. We do have some more witnesses, by the way. Go ahead.
Oh, if we have more witnesses, I can wait.
We have Tom Pritchard and Jim Stinzia. Sorry if I pronounced your name wrong. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Pritchard, President of the Minnesota Family Council, and I speak in opposition to this bill. We're not opposed to medically prescribed approved uses of marijuana, but we oppose our efforts to circumvent the drug approval process, which we see this bill doing. I think there are a number of issues we have with this bill, and we think the bill will put, frankly, a number of individuals in society's health at risk. And this is definitely not a tightly crafted bill. Obviously, you've heard some powerful testimony, but I think you have to look at the legislation and what it will actually do. This, as has already been stated, is supposedly designed to help very sick, terminally ill people, people with cancer, AIDS, and extreme pain. But if you read the language of the bill, this bill goes far beyond those situations. It allows a physician to recommend use of smoked marijuana by any individual, minor or adult, experiencing pain for at least 6 months, Section 2, Subdivision 2. That could be anything from a tennis elbow, a sore hip, bad knee, and a wide range of other pills which could easily be addressed by a couple of Tylenol pills. This legislation is not restricted to those in terminal situations. Also, there are no controls or directions on how to use the drug, and thus it makes a mockery of the drug approval and use process. Personally, in November of 2007, I went to the emergency room with intense abdominal pain. It was discovered I had a 7-inch mass in my abdomen. I was given morphine regulated by a doctor who was present. I was later given oxycodone, which has been mentioned, which is a derivative of opium, for pain relief. But if you look at the container, it says how much to use, how much to take, restrictions on refills, side effects, interactions with other drugs. It can cause breathing problems, don't take it with alcohol, et cetera, et cetera. But you get none of that with marijuana. And again, it's not restricted to those severe situations which were mentioned. Frankly, it was the testimony pointed out how powerful marijuana is. This legislation would allow somebody to grow 2.5 or to possess 2.5 ounces. That's the equivalent of over 100 joints of marijuana. And yet people testified that their family members were able to gain relief from only a couple of puffs. That just shows you, I believe, how open this bill is to abuse and the problems that it will cause. And just recently I saw where marijuana, which contains four times the amount of carbon monoxide and tar as your typical cigarette, is linked to testicular cancer. Another concern, I believe this will put the public's health at risk. Many think marijuana is simply an innocuous drug. In England in 2004, marijuana was downgraded from a Class B to a Class C drug. This resulted in increased crime and various health problems. It was reclassified as a Class B drug in 2008. They saw the problems by legalizing it. It also should be pointed out the American Medical Association, the American Cancer Society, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the National Multiple Sclerosis Society do not support the medical use of or legalizing marijuana, smoked marijuana for medical purposes. And this is a risk, I think, to the community and is open for abuse. This bill would allow 18-year-old boys to grow marijuana in their homes without any outside supervision. My reading of the bill says it would prevent landlords from regulating the growing and use of marijuana in their premises. And finally, I think it sends the wrong message to our young people. It needs to be pointed out that under marijuana laws currently, in California, only 2% of those who are given medical marijuana are prescribed are for cancer, AIDS, and glaucoma. In Colorado, a state similar to ours with a medical marijuana, only 8% of the patients. So over 90% of the patients are not getting it for these severe situations. Our concern also is this will open up allow marijuana dispensaries to set up shop across the state in homes, in storefronts on Main Street, in neighborhoods, in apartment buildings. Why? I think the only reason I can see is it will help to legitimize, frankly, the broader acceptance of marijuana in the community's eyes. In the eyes of young children who are told that marijuana is a dangerous, addictive drug, they're now going to be told that this is medicine. Marijuana is the number one drug that kids are in treatment for. One study found of nearly 182,000 children found that 48% were admitted for abuse or addiction to marijuana, only 19% for alcohol. And we can already look at California and other states which are already having problems. I think we have to realize the broader implications of this bill, and this bill, from what's been stated, will go far beyond that and open up a door for abuse. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pritchard. Mr.
Stinziani. Close enough. Thank you.
Please go ahead.
Thank you for allowing me to speak with you this afternoon. I don't have a I had a written statement. I'm driving down the freeway, and I hear about this meeting on the radio. And I have been involved as a private citizen with the LaRouche operation nationally. And if you know anything about that operation, they are very much against drugs. As the gentleman mentioned, basically it's a bigger situation just locally and medical marijuana. What's happening here, if anybody's familiar with George Soros, mega speculator billionaire, who basically is promoting and funding most of the drug operations that you're seeing in the United States. Now, the doctor mentioned, I think, 13 states have already legalized certain parts of this marijuana initiative. Let me read you something from the Executive Intelligence Review by Nancy Spanis, short expert here. George Soros, institutions promoting drug legalizations. George Soros established the Linda Smith Center and its Open Society Institute and the Drug Policy Foundation in 1992-1994, spending reported $500,000 in doing so. Over the following 3 years, 1994 to 1997, he both gave directly and mobilized marching funds up to the level of $10.5 million to fund these institutions and one of their offshoots, the Marijuana Policy Project, which promotes the legalization of marijuana, medicinal and recreational. The foot in the door is medicinal and harm reduction. In 2000, George Soros merged these two groups to create a drug policy alliance. Through this structure, including the Open Society Institute, Soros also funds a plethora of other drug legalization outfits, including NORML, National Organization of Reform of Marijuana Laws, and many other less obvious, like the Transnational Institute. These institutions also lobby with state legislatures and the federal government, pushing to change drug laws in the direction of legalization. This just gives you a tip of the iceberg. I have several articles. I've got dossiers in Mr. Soros. Some of you probably have seen these because we sent some of you folks these. Why we're doing it, I'm a private citizen. I got family, I got nephews, I got nieces. This is a foot in the door. This is a foot in the door because the bigger operation is drugs internationally, which is the most profitable operation in the world, bigger than oil. So I just wanted to give you some insights into this bigger operation of who's funding these initiatives. And I think if you check the backgrounds of these states and who basically funded them, I've got a copy of these articles. I'm available for distribution to anybody pro and con. And I appreciate your time very much.
Thank you for your time. Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is it Mr. Rasmussen?
No.
Is that your name?
No. Stenziani, Jim Stenziani.
Stenziani, okay. I just have to respond because you seem to be suggesting that yes votes from this committee mean we're supporting a large drug culture out there. A yes vote means yes to recreational marijuana, and that if I vote yes today, I support and endorse sort of free, widespread use, and I don't care about my grandchildren and younger nieces and nephews coming up the pike, and I want to expose them to a dangerous drug culture. And I think that's an extreme mischaracterization of the people who are going to be voting yes. That's not my position at all.
And I'm not suggesting, Senator. I'm not suggesting that anybody here.
I'm not finished with my statement.
You're shaking hands with George Soros. All I'm presenting here, and again, I'm a
Mr. Chair,
a private
citizen. I'm not finished with my statement.
Senator Erickson Ropes, go ahead.
Thank you. So, I just want to put that on the record because I see, people around the room here that care about our neighbors, our family members, friends, other citizens of the world who might be in situations where a drug of last resort may give them some comfort. And I think that's a decision that needs to be made between the doctor and the patients. And if it's a compound that works, I mean, actually, all drugs are drugs. All medication are drugs. So it depends on how, you're using the language. And then I just also like to make a comment to the two gentlemen who testified earlier and congratulate you on your sobriety. It's a really difficult life experience to get through. I think Senator Prettner-Solomon mentioned her husband was recovered and my husband is recovered. recovering, and we're very grateful members of that community. However, and with the greatest respect for your recovery, I would suggest that people who have trouble with drugs and alcohol don't always get into addictive cycles. There's many people in this room that drink wine and have beer and sometimes even hard alcohol mixed drinks and perhaps have even smoked marijuana that do not get hooked into the addictive processes. So by your logic of saying that marijuana is a gateway drug, I think disproves itself by the fact that many people in society don't fall into those chemical addictions that certain segments of society are vulnerable to. So if that were the case, you know, maybe we should be considering, as Senator Marty suggested, making tobacco illegal or wine illegal or beer illegal, because they have really severe consequences for some people in our society. So, Mr. Chair, that's all I want to say.
Thank you. Senator Prittner, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And also, Mr. Pritchard got away before I had a chance to make a response to him, too, but he suggested that perhaps the bill was poorly crafted and was opening the door. And in fact, the bill is written very tightly, identifying who a qualifying patient is, indicating that that person must have a debilitating medical condition diagnosed by a practitioner. There is a definition of what debilitating medical condition is, and it also states that the medical condition or treatment has to be approved by the commissioner. And it also states the amount and under what circumstances that the patient may have or possess the marijuana and very tightly identifies who may administer it for them also.
Mr. Pritchard.
Mr. Chair, Senator Solon. I would stand by my concerns, though, because it's allowing for 2.5 ounces to be in the possession, 12 plants can be grown for that individual. 2.5 ounces at any time is over 100 mm-hmm. joints per person. And as testimony pointed out, one or two puffs can address that problem. So I think it's opening the door for abuse. And I think the definition, if you look at it closely, it talks about intractable pain. Well, it's a pain somebody – that's one of the grounds in the legislation. And intractable pain is pain that which has existed for 6 months. Well, that's wide open, and that's a loophole I think you're going to get far beyond these terminal cases, which have been talked about. In fact, you see in other states where those terminal cases are just a small, small fraction. And so I think it does open the door for significant abuse.
Mr. Chair, and probably Mr. Pritchard, we're going to disagree on this, but by the same token, it needs to be prescribed and regulated or by a physician. So the physician has to determine that the person deserves it and that they fit this qualifying patient. And we've allowed our physicians to administer other types of medications, as others have said, that are also just as addictive. And certainly the OxyContin and the oxycodone that my husband had was far more than these 2.5 ounces of marijuana.
Senator Solon. My concern, though, is this is not a regulated drug. Those drugs give direction on how to be used and what form and shape. There is none of that in this legislation. And a physician can't just prescribe any sort of medication. They can't prescribe heroin. They can't inject that. There's all sorts of drugs they're restricted as to doing. What we're saying is go through the proper process to ensure that this is used properly. Don't allow 18-year-old boys to dispense marijuana and grow 12 plants per person, producing hundreds, if not thousands, of joints of marijuana. I think that's a recipe for big problems.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? If not, Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, and I want to make sure that Mr. Pritchard's camera is on me here. Okay, good. committee members, I go to a meeting every now and again, and it kind of starts off, and everybody goes around the room, and they kind of introduce themselves. And when it comes to me, I say, "Hi, my name's Steve. I'm an addict and an alcoholic. In 23 days, I will have been sober for 20 years. Now, the two gentlemen that came to the table who are also recovering can understand, and I can understand where they're at in the beginning of recovery. We're not talking about that here. We're not talking about the use of illegal drugs that are sold and marketed on the streets. And by the way, in this bill, if you have a card and you're able to use marijuana legally for medicinal purposes, it's a felony offense if you sell that marijuana. If you sell that card, it's a felony offense. Now, you could take the same marijuana, I could take it, have my little nickel bag or dime bag or whatever, and go out on the street and sell it to an undercover cop, and guess what? The penalties aren't that severe. They are not as severe as what is provided in this bill. So the sky is falling attitude out of some corners of this discussion is just that. It's Chicken Little running around saying that this is going to be bad. Now, folks talk about the California model. The California model was done by a ballot initiative. Some of the things that they have to deal with in California, lawmakers like us have no control over. Do you think they got a problem in California? I think if you talk with law enforcement out there, they would probably say yes. But if you talk to law enforcement in the state of Vermont, where the chief of the state patrol was asked, "What's up with medicinal marijuana?" "We don't have a problem with it," is what he said. "We don't have a problem with it. If it's regulated right and it's used by people that are looking for compassionate care," and that's what we're talking about, compassionate health care, "then it's not a problem." Now, folks want to make a distinction with this and OxyContin and things like that. Well, you know, OxyContin, when not used as prescribed by a doctor, is illegal. Ask Rush Limbaugh. Now, folks, they want to talk about the big war on drugs. I can tell you we lost that war. And this isn't about the war on drugs. This is about compassionate health care. Also talking about the FDA. We want FDA approval on this drug. I don't know. It looks like the FDA is doing really good with their salmonella peanut butter outbreak. Now, they won't even take a look at this under medicinal purposes. The FDA won't even take a look at it. I think that's a crying shame. Now, the state of Minnesota is better than that. And I think that we're as good, if not better, than those other 13 states that have adopted this as a law of their state. It's time to provide compassionate care to the families of those who have been affected. Senator Solon Sam was a good friend of mine. And a lot of us, so was Senator Sam's. And there were a lot of tears shed. Because, and we all know this, as being group of the elected members club, is that we're all family. And if we would just extend the borders of our family to include everybody in Minnesota, it would be a great day. We are all a family here. We're talking about compassionate health care. We're not talking about the war on drugs or Rush Limbaugh or anything else. This is about making a difference in a lot of families' lives. Mr. Chairman, I just want to thank the committee and the people who had the courage on both sides of the issue to stand up and speak their mind. I want to thank them because this is a very difficult issue for many people, and it's going to be a difficult vote for a lot of folks around this table and once we get to the Senate floor. But, you know, once again, to the families that have been affected and to the
people who came to testify in opposition. It takes a certain amount of courage to put your name on your ideas, and that's why we have this forum here. Thank you.
Senator Prettner-Solin moves.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh. Senator Hand and Senator Bergen.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and Senator Murphy, I appreciate your comments, and I know we had this bill in previous years, and I think that there has been efforts to try to address some of the concerns that were raised in the past, and I appreciate that. Just as you're suggesting that there could be in a part of some a sky is falling, and I'm certainly not there. There are also people, I think, like me, who believe that there probably are uses for marijuana that would be good and useful, and we should try to find a way to do that, but do have, nevertheless, legitimate concerns about the construction of the bill, and that's kind of where I'm at. And I do have concern about the broadness of the definition of a debilitating condition. I have, for almost all my life, suffered with migraine headaches. I would suspect that would be a debilitating condition. That, I don't know if that would be or not, but I suppose it could be, or you could particularly find a doctor who might say that that is a debilitating condition. I don't know. I'm not a doctor. But my point is simply this. And I don't disagree with you that maybe the FDA hasn't been appropriately looking at this as an issue, or maybe they have. I don't know. But there's nothing to prevent Minnesota from doing this in a different way, and maybe the way to do this would be to impanel a group of medical professionals in Minnesota to make recommendations on how to do things and deal with issues like dosages. And I have, frankly, concerns about how you control it. One thing about OxyContin and other prescribed drugs is that we know how much there is, where it is, who has it, where it's being sent to, who it's being given to. I'm not sure that under the conditions of this bill that we would know how much marijuana there is, who has it, where it's going. And these are just sort of procedural kinds of issues that I think could be dealt with. I don't think they're insurmountable, but I don't think they've been addressed sufficiently in the bill as it sits. And so I guess I'm wondering why it wouldn't be more appropriate to say, let's get a commission involving regulatory bodies in the state of Minnesota and medical practitioners and make some recommendations on how we would deal with this specific
Senator Hand,
issues.
I'm sorry to cut you off. Mr. Chairman, Senator Hand, we know what commissions do for us around here. If you see what the LCCCMR or whatever it's called these days has done, a citizens commission that would brought forward a plan, we tried to change it. If you look at the time that it takes for any committee that we establish to make a decision, there's going to be hundreds of families that would be able to access compassionate health care that are going to be alleviated. Now, this isn't rocket science. They've done it in other states. I understand some of the concerns you have about the construction of the bill, and we can exchange ideas on that because I believe you're on the next committee as well, the Judiciary Committee or... Well, maybe we'll take it to the Ag Committee. You're on the Ag Committee.
But Mr. Chairman, it is an ag product, I think. So, yeah.
Yes, it is. But, Mr. Chairman, Senator Hand, but, you know, the idea that we can take this product and, you know, hang a label on it as far as dosage, you know, you can talk to the doctor here or you can talk to any of the other healthcare professionals that are here. Talk to Senator Solin. Dosages, there's a reason why they say take 1 to 2 pills every 2 to 4 hours because, you know, a guy that's 205 pounds is probably going to react different than somebody that's 165. And that's just the way it is. And when it comes to dosages, OxyContin is known to have killed people. There has never in the history of this planet been a reportable overdose that resulted in death by THC, by marijuana. Never.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Murphy, and I'm not saying that I'm qualified, because I am not, to know what these things ought to be. But I do know that any other time you're dealing with prescription medications, there is always a formulary that is created that talks about things like dosages and drug interactions and safe quantities and other things. And all I'm saying is that I'm not qualified. I don't know if anybody in this room is qualified to make those determinations about marijuana. And there may very well be ranges depending on weight or other conditions or even maybe the medical condition itself. All I'm suggesting is that we should treat this drug in the way we treat other medicines. And if the federal government won't do it, and I'm a guy that says, well, the federal government doesn't always get it right, so maybe we should do it in Minnesota. But then let's do it in a way that is maybe a little bit distanced from the populism of a Senate committee and deal with it on more of a scientific basis in the hopes that we can get a good answer to what some of these questions are rather than relying on just our concern that we have legitimately for people that do have debilitating medical conditions for whom this looks like it is of help. And I'm not denying that at all. All I'm raising is concerns about the way the bill is written and the kinds of procedures it puts in place and whether those are consistent with the way we deal with other medicines and other drugs, and if not, why don't we seek to try to do that before we adopt the bill? That's all I'm just raising that concern.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if Senator Hahn, if you have some recommendations to tighten the bill up in regards to the law enforcement issue and things like that, I would be very interested in hearing them. So we can talk afterwards.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry I didn't raise this earlier, but I just wanted to ask, since we were talking about people who are concerned about those who are addicted, if any of the organizations that belong to the Minnesota Law Enforcement Coalition have expressed any concern about the 113,000 people who are potentially going to lose their chemical dependency coverage under the governor's budget, or any of the dozens after dozens of treatment programs that might go out of existence because of the rate cuts that they would experience under the governor's budget. I haven't heard from any of them, and if they are concerned about it, I hope we will.
And, Mr. Chairman, one last thing as I, you know, I used marijuana. I abused marijuana. All right? There you go, Mr. Pritchett, another one for the camera. And, folks, two things. One, if you have 2.5 ounces of marijuana, you're not going to get 100 joints out of it. And Senator Hahn, I know that from firsthand experience.
So. Don't dispute it.
Okay. But anyway, Mr. Chairman, once again, it's about compassionate care. It's, you know, it's, gosh darn it, you know, and you all have heard me talk about my dad and what he went through in the past. And, you know, my dad was one of those rough and tough, hard to buff kind of guys, Senator Hahn. And if he would have had the opportunity to use marijuana to, you know, quell some of the issues that he was having, he wouldn't have done it. I mean, you know, at the end, it was tough knowing how much pain he was in. It was tough to sit there and watch him be in that pain, and yet he didn't want to take that pain medication because he wanted to talk to his grandkids, and he wanted to see his great-grandson, you know? And, you know, when you're whacked out on OxyContin or whatever it is that they give you towards the end of life, you know, the quality of life just isn't that good. And we heard from the good doctor here about the experience. You know, well, we heard a couple experiences here today about families who chose to maybe go outside the bounds of the law. Why do we want to take people, professionals, Vietnam veterans, why do we want to take and make them criminals for something that is going to help their family? It's going to help them. I just, Senator Marty, I don't understand it, so I just don't understand that theory. But
Senator George Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to move the bill, but before I do that, Senator Murphy, I just wanted to thank you for doing all the work that you've done. I supported you on your effort last year, but I see that you have done a lot more work, and we have 16 pages in front of us. that really describe all of the restrictions. And I have a hard time listening to some of the opposition when they say that now if you, you know, need a couple of Advils, you can go to the doctor and get marijuana for a headache. I think that all of, you know, the language that was included in here clearly says that you can't do that. And so I invite them to read the legislation, read every line, so that they understand that that's not what they are, what we're doing today. And also that if there are doctors who will go that far and are going to lose their license, probably they shouldn't have never had a license to begin with. So when people describe, you know, irresponsible behavior, there will be consequences that are very well described in this legislation. And if they go as far as, you know, abusing this, they will lose their license. And I think that that is clear in this legislation. So I really commend you. This is 16 pages of legislation only to address this issue. I think that's pretty significant. And I think the public needs to know that, that this was very serious. And like Senator Erickson Robes described, this is something that all of us take very seriously. Many people gave input during a year or more so that these can be clear to the public. We're not really trying to encourage drug abuse. And so thank you for doing that, and thank you for having the courage to bring these to our attention.
Thank you, Senator Torres-Ray.
Senator Torres-Ray then moves Senate File 97 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Is there further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye. Aye.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Murphy. Senator Kubley, we've got one more bill left. So those who are leaving, please try and leave quietly so we can move ahead. Senator Kubley, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Please keep it quiet as you leave the room.
Well, again, Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 203 did pass last year. You know, well, I guess I was approached by Senator Lynch. I see she left the room here, but last year, Senator Lynch had asked if she could attach a bill of hers to it, and I looked at the bill. It was germane, so I told her, well, to go ahead. But the governor did veto the bill, and in his veto message, I'm not sure if you still have that, Mr. Chair. I do have a copy with me if there are questions about it. But there are no references to Senate File 203 in the governor's veto message. There are numerous references to Senator Lynch's bill that was attached to the bill last year. But, you know, I don't feel that the governor really had any objections to this. And we did get a review of it by the Attorney General's office, and I have a letter here from the Attorney General, Mr. Chair, supporting the bill and the variations that it's looking at trying to correct for this particular group. Copies. I just have a letter. So, yeah, I could have copied them off, Mr. Chair. I didn't think of that ahead of time.
If anybody wants to
look at it, I can surely share it with them. So.
And Senator Kubley, you have a delete everything amendment?
We do, Mr. Chair.
Senator Lori moves the A1 delete everything amendment. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Well, with that, Mr. Chair, I guess with me today is Chuck Ness, who's been the director of this co-op for a period of time, quite a period of time, maybe. But I think I'll just ask him to make a couple comments on the purpose of the co-op and where we're trying to go.
Okay. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
All right. Thank you for your time,
Mr. Chairman and Senators. My name is Chuck Ness. I'm the CEO of the Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative. We're based in Cottonwood, Minnesota, western Minnesota. We have 23 critical access hospitals, and I believe it's 34 clinics in that area in 21 counties. The furthest east we come, just so you kind of know the geography of it, is Glenwood, Litchfield area, and then the northern part, we have an outlier in Monoman, but otherwise it's Elbow Lake, and then down south to Slayton, so, and then South Dakota border. So we don't have all the clinics and hospitals in that area, but we have a lot of them. Basically, we were formed in 1995 under the Health Care Reform Act that was passed back then, legislation 62R, allowing us to do things together as a cooperative. One of the main reason, frankly, we started, and I was involved in that when I was a clinic administrator in Montevideo, and I was one of the founding board members of the cooperative at that time. And at the time, we were very dominated, and still are to a large degree, by one major health plan. And some of the other health plans were somewhat interested in coming out, but even that larger health plan was kind of focusing on some of the larger clinics and hospitals, not that interested in contracting with all of them. And, of course, we have a very high percentage of Medicare and medical assistance patients out there. So not only would it limit access to health care had that happened, that played out, it would have probably doomed a lot of the hospitals and clinics to failure simply because they can't survive on Medicare and medical assistance alone. Anyway, over time, we did a number of contracts bringing health insurance options to other parts of that state, about 11 contracts. And then we also do other, along with those contracts, we do centralized credentialing, site visits, which is part of credentialing, and quality projects, patient satisfaction surveys, a lot of other services that are related to just helping our hospitals and clinics do their work. I made a copy, I think that was distributed earlier, but I'll just read these for you if I could. Well, first I'll just say we're a very small organization, 4 full-time equivalents, our budget's roughly $600,000 a year. Our values of the co-op include: the Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative values local decision-making, maintaining a high-quality, effective, and cost-efficient system of health care which meets local needs, and preserving the overall health of our communities, physical as well as economic. And our mission, is a cooperative effort of physicians and hospitals to preserve and maintain health care resources and access in the local community, with local community choice and control for member communities in rural Minnesota. So, again, we're hopeful that this legislation can be passed, which will basically strengthen, as I understand it, strengthen 62R, providing adequate or better state oversight of our contracting efforts, which we find very valuable, and where there's no fiscal impact to the state, we're paying for it.
Thank you, Mr. Ness. Any questions from members? Senator Bergen.
Well, first thing I'd like to do is to move the bill for Senator Kugle, and then the second thing I'd like to just suggest, as this bill moves along, that you might want to think about the way this bill is set up now. This is a one-time thing. So you get approval on submission and you pay a fee on submission. And it might be more appropriate to have this reviewed periodically, these arrangements, because it might change. It might not always stay the way they are intended to be when they start out. And so you might want to just think about that as the bill is moving along.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question about the bill itself. This antitrust immunity provision that you're talking about, my sense is that you have antitrust laws to prevent collusion, which is a safeguard to consumers, to prevent organizations from getting together and agreeing on prices for things that then do not f- fall under any kind of competitive scrutiny, and so therefore they tend to, over time, go up without any reasonable check on their rise in cost, because you have no way to, bring a lower price into that market. And so there is, in my understanding, some good rationale to have antitrust law. It's essentially anti-monopoly law. And you're asking for this to be set aside in this case, and I'm just wondering why, and what is to be the protection to consumers to prevent the prices to go up in a way that is uncontrollable? Or why, if this is good, wouldn't it be good more broadly? Why wouldn't we just say, let's create big trusts and give them power to set prices for the whole state of Minnesota, for example? What's the rationale for this? I'm struggling with that.
Well,
Ness.
Oh, thank you. We believe this was addressed or attempted to be addressed in the original legislation as 62R. I'm not a legal expert, but I think the intent was to allow some collective bargaining or collective negotiation on behalf of these smaller entities in rural areas in particular, and allow them to work with the health plans in this case, and try and negotiate, represent a number of facilities and clinics. I guess our thinking is on this is that it's beneficial to our members in that they don't have, it's one less thing they kind of have to do. They can basically delegate this to us, and there's quite a bit of time and effort and staff involved in this. So it's a cost saving to them, but it's also a cost saving to the health plans. I guess our thinking of it is that we're it levels the playing field a little bit, possibly. We're a lot of our places, you know, I have solo practitioners out there that may just be not even, again, initially in the mid-90s, health plans had no interest in even talking to them because they, why bother? They just wanted to cherry pick some of the bigger facilities. As far as, a thought of a monopoly, I mean, there's the biggest providers out there aren't even part of our organization. And frankly, we don't really recruit anybody to be part of this. Rice Hospital, for example, in Kandi, Ojai County, was part of our organization. They dropped out a couple years ago. Affiliated Community Medical Center is a large multi-specialty clinic in the middle of our territory and has like six locations all around it. They've never been part of us. So, you know, there's options already. I mean, I think there's roughly the same amount of people employed by Affiliated that are as providers than are in our all of our sites. So it's so the health plans can come out and talk to three or four different provider groups in that area, and they've got that whole chunk of territory just kind of wrapped up. I guess it's kind of a win-win in a way. We continue to negotiate with health plans. We haven't heard any major concerns from any of the health plans we're working with. Matter of fact, some of them, we've talked about the possibility of not being able to contract on behalf of all these members, and some of them got kind of upset because they're going to have to hire people. We have roughly 50 different locations. We have 23 hospitals, 35 clinics, 34 clinics roughly. Some of them are owned by the hospital, so they'd have to send out somebody to, you know, one location at each of these sites, you know, every year or two, depending on how many contracts they do, just for the contracting piece. And I can tell you a normal health plan contract might take 6 to 10 meetings. So, I mean, it's a big issue for them. And that's kind of a one-stop shopping and just added efficiencies. I mean, if we were right in the metro, it probably wouldn't make a lot of sense because they can just come over or we could come in there. But, I think on one of the sheets I think was distributed, just some round-trip mileage just from Minneapolis using MapQuest. Manoman, 484 miles round-trip. Wheaton to the west, it's 376 round-trip. And Slayton is 366. So, I mean, you're talking a lot of driving around, and then also the credential, the site visits, they have to come out as well every couple of years. But, and then also the quality projects we do jointly. You know, we're helping our members do it. The health plans like it because then some of the stuff actually gets done. You know, a lot of these very small clinics, it's a huge burden for them to get this done. One ex- I don't know if that answers your questions.
Well, I assume that you're currently operating without this immunity. Are there lawsuits being brought against you on the basis of this that this would be a relief for? Or
There is no lawsuit. There is an inquiry by the Federal Trade Commission where they're looking at us. That started because of an issue with we were assisting pharmacies, and the pharmacy benefit managers didn't care for that, so that's what started it. So we're no longer working with the pharmacies.
So, Madam Chairman, if we were to adopt this law, what would would this be interfering into a federal legal action if we did this? I mean,
There isn't, as I understand it, there isn't any legal action. You know, they're just looking at us, they're talking to us. So.
But I guess, Madam Chairman, I guess what I was trying to find out is that if we do this, does that, in effect, dismiss the inquiry? In other words, under federal law right now, there's some questions being raised that are being looked at, and if we pass this law, that would remove the basis for that? Is that essentially it? Is this sort of relief from that scrutiny?
Yes, basically. They would like more state supervision, and this meets it, as I understand it.
Madam Chair, I'm not quite sure I understand what exactly we're doing. I'm a little leery of doing something to relieve the provisions to protect against monopolistic behavior. I'm not quite sure if I get the whole story here, and I'm a little uncomfortable with this, I guess, but I don't know.
Senator Kubley, do you have any response?
Well, I don't know, Madam Chair. I mean, it seems to me that the PBMs are detrimental to a lot of rural practices. We don't have the numbers out there that they have here in the metropolitan area. But nevertheless, I mean, it seems to me that we ought to give the same kind of benefit to a rural pharmacy that we give to PBMs. I mean, it seems to me that the PBM's inquiry is directed at, you know, scaring off the competition, which is more monopolistic than the kinds of things that that a co-op is doing like this. You know, at least that would be my read on it. I don't know if you'd agree with that, Mr. Ness. But.
Well, you know, the bottom line is we've is that we've been operating, been doing this now since, holding at least five contracts with health plans since 97. And to our knowledge, there was never any problems with it. You know, it's a benefit. Again, there's some letters of support that I think were distributed from health plans that want this to continue. So, you know.
Mr. Chairman, one last question. Do you have any idea what the impact this would be on consumers' cost? If we did this, would they go up? Would they go down? Would they stay the same? What's the impact of doing this?
I don't think what we do would really impact patients very directly at all. You know, if anything, if we were able to get better reimbursement, for example, from some contracts, then the hospitals or clinics theoretically wouldn't have to raise their prices trying to get more money from private pay people. You know, so theoretically, that if they need to cost shift from state or federal programs, they wouldn't have to raise their prices as much. So I don't know. I think it'd be a wash. I mean, we're minimal business.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hahn, I guess, you know, I've been on my local hospital board for 16 years. In four of those years, we lost money. You know, anywhere from about $40,000 up to about $180,000. What the cooperative does is helps those rural hospitals and clinics stay in business, really. I mean, they're giving them a little bit of a margin that they would not otherwise have if they were not participants in the cooperative, that helps them to maintain a cash flow that allows them to stay in business and serve the communities that they serve.
you know, in a rural area, you don't have a lot of choice. You know, if your health care plan asked you to choose the lowest cost provider statewide and transportation was up to you, I suspect you'd have to come to my part of the state, or you'd have to go to the northwest corner, and you wouldn't like that at all. But you'd like it even less if the place where you went closed and you had to travel a little further. You know, I think, you know, this is just an attempt to be creative in ways that help rural communities to have the services available that are needed for a standard of living.
Senator Berglund moved the bill, did I?
Yeah, and it should go to finance.
Senator Berglund moves.
Oh, Commerce wants it?
Commerce wanted it first. Mm-hmm. Senate file 203 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce. Oh, Mr. Griffin, did you wish to speak to the bill?
Mr. Chairman, if I might please, members of the committee, my name is Phil Griffin. I'm a lobbyist. I represent both UCARE and Preferred One, and I'm speaking today on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. I apologize to Senator Kubley. He and I have not had an opportunity to discuss this. We thought the bill was moving on the House side. I have spoken to the House author, Representative Hosh, and we are trying to meet with him and have scheduled a meeting for early next week. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we are opposed to this legislation, and I think Representative Han, you've put your finger right on the issue. The FTC is investigating this organization. They are investigating it because they believe that there is some cause for looking at whether or not they're violating antitrust laws. Senator Berglund, I think, is the only member of the committee right now that was here when we had some very, very long and protracted antitrust investigations of providers by the Attorney General's office that resulted in some fairly large, tens of millions of dollars settlements in the late 1980s under Attorney General Humphrey. We believe that this is a bad idea. The federal government will allow the states to give antitrust exemptions to certain businesses. They have to meet two requirements. One of them is a state interest, which if you pass a piece of legislation, this will give those providers that state interest. The other one is, quote, sufficient state involvement. And I think that's the attempt to bring the Department of Health into this legislation to oversee it. We don't see what they're putting into this bill as sufficient state involvement. And we really believe that if you want to do something, you wouldn't put in a 60-day default requirement that says if the commissioner doesn't look at this, then by default, it's automatically approved. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we take the antitrust laws very seriously in the state. Every time we sit down as an organization at the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, we review an antitrust statement to make sure that we aren't colluding to either set prices or to divide up geographic territories. These are the things that are the key parts of business to prevent people from acting in anti-business ways against competition. And this legislation is clearly designed to set that up. I'm very curious to find out who the people are that are supporting this legislation that are listed as health plans. And I'm very interested in working with the author to try and figure out what's going on. We are very clearly in a situation in which providers in the rural part of the state, as well as in the metro part of the state, have very difficult problems trying to solve this issue of how to deal with uncompensated care, the lack of public payments that meet the commercial market rates that they demand as providers and need as providers, and the ever-increasing pressure that we have on health care premiums. But we don't believe that simply saying there's an exemption from antitrust laws is the way to get there. Mr. Chairman, members, I again apologize to Senator Kubley for not having a chance to talk to him before the hearing today, but we would urge you not to pass this legislation. If there are questions, Mr. Chairman, members, happy to take them.
Senator Han.
Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Griffin, you said you're interested in finding who the providers were. What's the problem in finding them out?
Mr. Chairman, I didn't say the providers. I said who the plans were that were supporting this. I heard the proponents say that they had provided letters from the plans that are supportive of this. And I represent two of the eight licensed health plans in the state.
We got a letter, Senator Han, in the packet from UCARE supporting it.
Mr. Chairman, one of my clients, and I'm very interested to see what the letter says. I have not seen it.
Senator Berglund renews her motion that Senate File 203 as amended be recommended pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce. Further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. With that, we have finished the business of the committee for the day, so the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you for your time.
In 60 days, but if they don't.